Are you ready to make the most of your oil and gas mineral rights? Welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. Get the knowledge and resources you need to manage your minerals and royalties. Here is your host, Matt Sands.
Hello and welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Sands, and I'm here to help you make the most of your mineral rights and royalties. And my co-host, Justin Williams, is here with me today as well. Hey, Justin, how's it going today?
Hey, Matt, doing good. How are you? And, you know, we were talking about this before the show here that we weren't sure if this is feeding our own internal history buffs or whether the audience will enjoy this, but I sure hope that they get as much from it as we have.
Absolutely. And what Justin's referring to is today's topic, which is the history of the oil and gas industry and some of the major technology advances really since the first modern well was drilled by Edwin Drake in 1859. So we're going to walk you through sort of a Reader's Digest version of the history of drilling and completing wells and, you know, some of the major advancements in the technology, how it's become safer, more efficient, more effective, and lower environmental impact. And so we'll just go ahead and dive in because, you know, as we were going through and preparing the story, like Justin mentioned, it was really fun to go back and learn about some of these old technologies that were used and how they used to drill wells before the modern rotary drilling rig was invented. So, you know, this is something where you look at oil and gas industry, and having worked in the industry for my whole career, it has seemed to be slow in adopting new technologies. But after doing the research for this episode, it seems like we have some pretty major advancements in technology. And, you know, it might be just that we've been alive for just the latter part where maybe it seems like it has moved kind of slowly, Justin, but it's pretty impressive the amount of change that's occurred in the industry since, you know, 162 years ago when it first started.
It sure is. You know, some of those people that worked back in those days, they just wouldn't even be able to recognize the equipment and the machinery. And the thing that really stands out to me is the number of lives that were committed to improving this and advancing the technology and dedicated to continuing to move it along. And like you were saying, maybe we haven't seen all of the advancements, but this is many lifetimes that it's taken to get from where we're starting to where we finish.
That's a great point. And, you know, the thing that has really changed is the uses of crude oil, and some of those advancements have propelled some of the technology changes in the oil and gas industry as well. So that's been kind of cool to see, you know, new elastomers are developed for better securing a wellbore, you know, during a blowout and with a blowout preventer, and so that you could prevent an accident from happening. Whereas in the past, they were just sort of drilling, you know, an open hole and, you know, hoping for the best, and they'd have these big gushers, and sometimes those would catch on fire and burn down the wooden oil derrick, and it was a big safety issue. And certainly that was one of the first things that was addressed. And so, you know, one of the things that's really interesting as we talk about the oil and gas industry is the fact that crude oil has been used for centuries. And in fact, I think in China, I remember seeing something about using oil that was occurring in some of the natural oil seeps there back, you know, thousands of years ago. And, you know, similarly in the United States, we had our own, you know, oil seeps. You know, you have the Bray tar pits. I don't know if you've heard of those in California, but those existed, you know, for centuries, and people would go and take a cupful of the oil and maybe use it for a tonic or for some sort of natural remedy and maybe to light, you know, their home. But it wasn't really until the first modern oil well was drilled, again, like I mentioned, by Edwin Drake in 1859 in Titusville, Pennsylvania, like we mentioned in our episode about the most notable boom and bust in the oil industry, which is our last episode, which was 130. So if you haven't listened to that yet, definitely go back and listen to it, because we talk about the ups and downs that the industry has taken and some of those the factors that have contributed to that. But one of the things that occurred after that first oil boom that followed Drake's discovery was that, you know, intrepid entrepreneurs came in and found ways to profit from this new energy transition. So this first energy transition was really from the hunting of whales for whale oil to light towns and cities, to the early chemists that were experimenting with distilling this crude oil into kerosene and other products to use for lighting and for machine energy. And so this was the first, I think, real energy transition, Justin. We're in an energy transition right now, probably could be argued away from fossil fuels towards maybe what's, you know, hopefully eventually getting to more renewable sources of energy. We got a long ways to go, but you know, this is, we're in this kind of first energy transition that we're going to talk about today, which I thought was pretty interesting to think about.
No, absolutely. And, you know, if you think back to those days, I'm sure that that was just as monumental to them going from candle to using whale oil and then trying to find another alternative, because I'm sure it didn't take too long to realize that hunting the whales wasn't super sustainable.
That's right. Yeah, we almost hunted them to extinction. So that was not good at all. And so certainly there were some positive environmental impacts from the transition to crude oil. You know, we're saving the whales. You know, we've stopped hunting them for the oil, and you know, which is a good thing. And you know, one of the things that was interesting about that Drake well, we'll talk about some of the technologies that he used. And, you know, many will cite his discovery as the beginning of the modern oil and gas industry. And there's a couple of reasons for this. The first one is that Drake had invented a new technique for drilling, which, you know, some of which are used today still, like the process of driving a conductor pipe into the ground to stabilize the surface hole when you first start drilling. And so this is where they will drive a pipe into the ground down to bedrock, in the case of Drake. And, you know, allow them to drill out the middle of that pipe, the center of the pipe, and extract the dirt and rock and all that stuff that's in there and keep out the water. Because what would happen in the past, the, you know, just drilling straight into the ground, then the water would start to come into the hole and cause it to collapse and fill around the drill pipe or the bit, and then they would get it stuck. And so that was always an issue when they first started to figure out, okay, we're going to start drilling. How do we do this in a way that we can keep going after we get that first part of the kind of surface hole with the dirt and soil and all that stuff that could slough in and cause issues? And so this technique is used today. They still go and drive conductor pipes into the ground before they bring a rig on site to drill the surface hole. They'll put those conductor pipes in the ground. And this was a major improvement in the first sort of application of that technology to drilling for oil. And then before that Drake discovery as well, the type of rig that they would use was more akin to something I would consider like a caveman using, Justin. I was pretty surprised at the technology, if you call it that. But this spring pole, which would be like a bent tree that they would use to basically repeatedly beat a hole into the ground using ropes and chisels. So it was just basically brute force trying to use something to knock down vertically to try to smack and crack the rock and break it up. And then they'd have to go and extract it and pull it out of there and then keep smacking it. And it was very slow and arduous task.
Absolutely. And I'm sure extremely difficult and energy consuming, whether it's energy from humans or energy from a machine. It's good that they came up with a more effective way.
Absolutely. And one of the things that was a big advancement that Drake used in that Drake well was the use of what's called cable tooled drilling. And so this is where you would see that modern oil derrick. So for the first time, they had an oil derrick, which would set high above the ground. In this case, these original ones were maybe 80 feet tall and made from wood initially. And this is where they also shifted away from human power and horsepower to steam boilers to power the what they called a walking beam, which was used to raise and lower drilling tools. And so this was still a pretty rudimentary drilling rig. So the one that Drake used in some of those first wells in the 1800s was basically using a iron pipe that was repeatedly dropped down and smacked into the ground. So you'd have the chisel or the drill bit, which was at the bottom of that heavy pipe, and it would basically be raised up by that steam engine, dropped down, raised up, dropped down, and then that just continued. And they had to stop frequently to remove the rock cuttings and to bail the water out from the hole. And so they didn't have any mechanism to continually clean the wellbore out as they drilled. And so it was a very slow and arduous task. And, you know, it's really no wonder that they could only drill a few feet per day using this technique.
Absolutely. It's a miracle they could drill a few feet per day.
Yeah, it was very slow and arduous. And really, like I mentioned, it was an open hole drilling scenario. And so this is where that first well, it was going slow. A lot of the investors gave up on Drake. He kept going and they left one night, came back the next morning and found that there was a pool of oil at the bottom of the hole that they had been drilling. So that was really the first sign that they were on the right track. And, you know, this cable tool drilling rig that used a 6-horsepower steam engine and a wooden derrick was famous for sort of revolutionizing oil drilling at the time. And then it wasn't very long before the next advancement in drilling technology occurred. And so do you want to talk about that, Justin?
Yeah, absolutely. So the next major advancement was the rotary drilling rig, which is still in use today, albeit a little bit more complicated than the original version. The new technology utilized to drill the famous Spindletop Gusher near Beaumont, Texas. Rotary rigs replaced that repeating pounding away with a cable tool rig with the concept of a rotating drill bit that featured a hollow drum stem, whereby drilling fluids could be pumped downhole to flush out the rock as the drill bit chipped away at the rock. The process is much more efficient and had the side benefit of providing hydrostatic pressure at the bottom of the well. So Matt, I'm sure this was just revolutionary, even more so than the horsepower. And it changed from something where you're just absolutely pounding it to actually using a rotary force.
That's absolutely right. And you know, the benefit too of that hydrostatic pressure and that drilling mud and all of that is that those blowouts that used to occur in those open hole drilling rigs was that that kind of prevented that from happening. So you had all that pressure from that column of liquid in the actual wellbore, which helped keep the oil and gas, which was under pressure down at the bottom of the wellbore, from violently escaping and causing a blowout. So that is one of the major revolutions in drilling technology that was a side effect of that rotary drilling.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the blowout there. And, you know, I think we've all heard of a gusher. That's a phrase that I think everybody in the oil and gas industry has heard. And a gusher is referring to that blowout. And that blowout, like Matt mentioned, is a dangerous situation where the oil and gas under pressure shoots out of the hole into the air. And it's a bad situation for many reasons. It's wasteful. It can cause an explosion or fire if the oil and gas is ignited. And in 1924, the first blowout preventer was invented, which largely stopped this dangerous, uncontrolled situation from happening. A blowout preventer is a large, high-pressure valve, which uses hydraulic pressure to close and seal around the drill's string, or in rare emergencies, actually shear the drill pipe and completely seal the hole. The early rotary drilling rigs were steam-powered and did not have directional drilling capabilities. Steam boilers presented a potential safety issue, and many drillers died from boiler explosions. And Matt, you read the book Roughnecks, Drillers, and Tool Pushers by Gerald Lynch, and I actually had stumbled across this book because it mentioned my ancestors, and I really enjoyed his account of working in the oil fields from the 1920s to the 1950s. Do you want to talk a little bit about what he mentioned in that book, Matt?
Sure. Yeah. And thanks for letting me borrow that book. It was Justin that turned me onto that book as well. And, you know, it's pretty fascinating to hear the stories of these early oil and gas pioneers. And the author recounts his fear of a boiler explosion in these original steam-powered rigs. And there was a particular rig that he was working on that he talked about that I guess was prone to maybe having an issue keeping track of how much water was in the boiler. And so sometimes the water would get to dangerously low levels. They would have to go and refill the water levels, and that would basically mean introducing cold water into a hot boiler. And that is one way that boiler explosions can happen because of thermal shock on that pressure vessel. And so he would, if that happened in that rig, he recounted a time where he would refill the water level and go run and hide behind a big tree where this one location that they were drilling, and he was happy because that tree was close to the doghouse where he was working. That doghouse is the place where the driller sits and operates the rig. So he would run and hide behind that tree because he was worried that the boiler would explode. And when a boiler explodes, it's like a stick of dynamite going off, or it's like a other type of explosion. So it can definitely cause a lot of damage and kill people. And so in fact, this particular rig that he didn't like working on because of this dangerous situation, he was happy that he left. And he actually recounted in that book how the next driller that took over for him on that rig after he moved to another company or to another rig to work on was killed by a boiler explosion when, you know, he didn't have a tree to go run and hide behind. So that was an unfortunate situation that sometimes occurred. Certainly things got safer as these new technologies came to be. And, you know, we had advancements in powering the drilling rigs that were made in the 1950s, and you had diesel generators replacing the steam boiler. And today, a lot of rigs are powered by natural gas generators, or sometimes even just by simply hooking it up to the grid and powering it by electric power. So, you know, from an emission standpoint, that's clearly better. You know, certainly in urban areas or areas where there's access to the grid and you want to be quieter, then they'll hook it directly up to electric power. Sometimes it's obviously not available if you're out in the middle of nowhere and you have to provide another energy source. But a lot of times if you're drilling in an area where there's already natural gas production, you can tap into that and power the rig from that. So that's a pretty big advancement that's occurred as well.
Absolutely. And so the next advancement here is something that is starting to make it seem much more familiar to me. I don't know about you, Matt, but historically drilling rigs turned the drill bit through the drill pipe, which is driven using the motor connected to a Kelly bushing, which mated to a specialized piece of drill pipe called the Kelly. The Kelly bushing was fixed to a rotating table at the drill rig floor. As the bit drilled deeper, new sections of drill pipe were added to the bottom of the Kelly section. And this is something, Matt, that I think as a kid growing up in West Texas, that was what I always noticed. I noticed all the pipes stacked up, and I noticed that they would be feeding these links of pipe down into the hole. And you know, as a kid, I'm wondering, where's that going? Where does that go? And since then, advancements like the use of top drive motors to turn the drill string. The top driver is a rotary motor assembly at the top of the drill pipe and travels along the drill rig mast as the well is drilled. The advantage of the top drive is that it allows the application of rotation while pulling out of the hole. This can help prevent the drill bit from getting stuck, which is not their favorite thing. A more recent development is the use of a downhole mud motor to apply torque to the drill bit. In these systems, the drill pipe is not rotated, but instead pumping mud down the drill string towards a pump at the bottom of the drill string above the drill bit, which then applies torque directly to the bit. These advancements in drilling technology have made it more feasible to apply directional control to where the bit travels. In the past, wells were drilled vertically into the formation, which allowed for a very limited amount of exposure to that target formation or the layer of rock where oil and gas was thought to be found. Now there are much more advanced types of directional control, like rotary steerable systems, which may use a Kelly or top drive to turn the bit, but special computerized controls apply force to the drill pipe in a certain direction just above the drill bit to steer it where they want it to go. And so, Matt, just that paragraph there, it seems like a major change in oil and gas, especially being able to control where that bit's going rather than just, you know, putting a straw into a drink straight down.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly in the past, you know, this technology has advanced as well. In the past, they would have to trip out of the hole, maybe put a survey tool in and go and see where they were at and then go back. Okay, we're here. We need to correct and go this way. So it was somewhat of a slow and tedious process. Now it's gotten to the point where it's so advanced that you have a geologist sitting in the office working remotely and monitoring the exact position of that drill bit in the formation. And so they can actually steer. So the geologist is involved in steering the drill bit to ensure that drill bit stays in that target formation so that the wellbore stays in the formation as much as possible as it travels horizontally thousands of feet from that surface hole location where the rig is located. So it's pretty impressive that they're now drilling, 2 to 3 mile laterals, even longer, I think, maybe in some sort of experimental wells. But it's very common now to have a 2 mile lateral, in these horizontal wells that are being drilled. In fact, it's pretty much the norm now. So it's pretty impressive that you have the application of force in a specific direction 2 miles away from where you're sitting on this drilling rig, and the technology and everything working together that you can steer that drill bit in real time and see where it's going. And so things have really advanced quite a bit. And, you know, the reason that this is important, I think, is that we've gotten to the point where it's been it's so much more efficient to drill a well. You know, they can do it a lot quicker, so you have less, obviously less time involved. You can maximize the productivity of that formation, so you're not having to drill as many wells. And we'll talk about the environmental benefits of all these technology improvements here in a minute. But, you know, the thing that was really interesting is that they drill vertically down to the desired depth and then start turning the bit until it hits that target depth and that target formation. And then they just keep going for several miles, like I mentioned. And that's what's called horizontal drilling. And like I mentioned, the benefits of horizontal drilling is that fewer wells have to be drilled in order to produce the oil and gas in that section or maybe two sections of land. So in the past, when vertical wells were drilled, depending on the ideal well spacing in that area, you might have a well drilled every 20 acres of land, just as an example. And if you have a typical 640-acre section with that 20-acre spacing, you would end up with 32 separate well pads, each with their own well and the associated production equipment, like a pump jack and tanks to store produced oil and water. And so what you end up with is a significant surface disturbance. And if you've flown over areas like Bakersfield, California, or flown over West Texas, and you look down, you see a patchwork of roads and well pads just pockmark over the surface of the earth. So it's very much, you know, disturbs a lot of land. And, you know, so this combination of using horizontal pad drilling, which really started to take hold in the early 2000s, what you end up with is these same 640-acre sections could be drilled from a single well pad. And you have the horizontal well bores extending and stretching out under that section in, you know, kind of evenly spaced. So they're still able to produce, in fact, they're able to produce more of that formation, extract more of the oil and gas with a smaller surface footprint. So, you know, definitely has a lot lower environmental impact from that standpoint. And then, you know, we have companies like Mitchell Energy, which really pioneered that combination of horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing in the Barnett Shale near Fort Worth. And so all these, you know, different techniques used to drill the well, there's other innovations that have occurred in the ways that the wells are completed. And that completions process is what we're referring to when we say hydraulic fracturing. That's sort of the modern method for completing a well. And so usually what happens when you go to drill a well, you have different groups that work on the engineering, the different parts of the well. There's a drilling engineer that writes the procedure basically for the drilling contractor to go and drill the well in a certain way. And then they will bring in the completions engineer who has a separate procedure for how the well should then be completed. So what you have is very specialized engineers that focus on the different technologies, the tools, the practices with, you know, again, specialized contractors that manage that work in the field. And they work hand in hand to make sure that the well is built basically in the way that it is most efficient and effective, and the way that the company thinks that is going to maximize production and make sure that there's certain safeguards in place. So that technology and that combination of, you know, again, the hydraulic fracturing really unlocked the shale revolution in the 2000s. And, you know, I think hydraulic fracturing has gotten a bad name for no good reason. And an interesting factor, Justin, that I learned as we were doing research for this was that fracturing was actually invented in 1865 by Edward A.L. Roberts with his patent for the use of an explosive device. It was lowered downhole to the target depth, and then the wellbore was filled with water to concentrate the resulting explosion to the oil-bearing rock. And this device that he invented was called the torpedo. And that resulting explosion caused fracturing to occur in the formation deep below the ground and caused, as you would expect, a dramatic increase in well productivity as these natural fractures were now interconnected with these artificial fractures which went to the wellbore. And so now they had more surface area exposed to the oil and gas. So I thought that was a pretty interesting invention that occurred back then.
Absolutely, yeah. And fact that it's in 1865, and you know, I think even the worst opponent of hydraulic fracturing might not think it's so bad in comparison to that the 1865 patent there.
That's a good point. So, you know, they do still put down explosive charges to perforate the well in the locations where they want to fracture. So there's, you know, very specialized tools that are very safe. It's like putting shotgun shells in the tool. So it's not like they're having to handle it like a package of nitroglycerin, like in Robert's torpedo. So we're a lot safer than that. And so what they would do with these today in the modern day fracture treatment, they perforate the casing in a specific pattern. Again, they have engineers that run computer simulations that say, okay, if we perforate the well, then fracture it in a certain way, this is how we think the fractures are going to propagate, how long, you know, here's how far apart we need to space these fractures. And so a lot of engineering goes into this. Certainly there's some trial and error that goes along with it as well, so that, you know, you have a hypothesis maybe that an engineer comes up with based on a computer simulation. They go and test it in the field. If it works, they then tweak it again and then maybe apply that to future wells that they drill in that area. Or if it doesn't work, they'll go back to the drawing board and then try to figure it out again. So there's a lot of collaboration that occurs within the different disciplines that are trying to figure this stuff out. You know, there was no, as you go into a new formation, especially as these new shale formations were started to be explored, there was no manual for, okay, this is how exactly you need to drill this well and how you need to complete it. So they came in and said, well, this is what we think based on these factors, you know, the data that we have, this is how we think we ought to try to complete it, and let's go see if it works. And so they would continually tweak it. And this is still the case today. You know, they've got a lot of data and they've drilled thousands and thousands of these wells that now we have a lot better idea of what we're doing. But still they go and try to tweak, you know, how much sand we pump down there, how much water and that kind of a thing. And so we'll talk about that here in a second. But what a fracture treatment is, or hydraulic fracturing refers to, is basically the use of specialized high pressure pumps to pump down sand, which is also called proppant. Because it props open the tiny fractures in the rock once the rock is fractured, and then allows it, the oil and gas, to flow through the cracks. So the sand, water, and then other chemicals are pumped down hole. And those other chemicals are really primarily meant to keep the proppant entrained in the liquid. So they're gelling agents. And so what you end up with is 99% water and sand and about 1% of other additives. And a lot of times those additives that are found in the highest concentration are, again, some sort of gelling agent, and like a guar gum, which is like a food grade. And so there's a lot of bad press. And, you know, I think people think, oh my God, there's all these toxic chemicals that are being pumped downhole. And the fraction, it's, you know, thousands of a percent of what compared to the water and sand. You know, they do pump down sometimes things like corrosion inhibitors, biocides, friction reducers, and acid, and all this stuff to maybe normalize the pH to prevent bacteria from growing. Because one of the interesting things that you can get is if you pump down water that contains bacteria into the formation, it can start to cause a reaction to occur. Well, it'll start to metabolize some of the oil and stuff that it likes to eat. And as a byproduct, one of the waste products that's generated is H2S, or hydrogen sulfide, which is a toxic and deadly substance, and certainly causes a lot of issues with the equipment that's put downhole. Can cause a lot of corrosion and cause incompatibilities if you don't use the right grade of metals and things like that. And so they want to make sure that doesn't happen. So they want to put biocides in that water to prevent bacteria from contaminating that formation and causing H2S to form. So these are very practical things that are used in only the concentrations necessary to prevent issues from happening. The thing that, if you're interested in finding out more, there's a website called fracfocus.org that has more information. In fact, you can find out the exact chemicals that were pumped into the wells that you are paid royalties on if you want to go that far and look that up. And many state oil and gas commission websites link directly to this Frac Focus database for your wells, or you can search directly for your wells on the Frac Focus website for this information if you're curious. But, you know, it's something that I do think has gotten a lot of bad press, and there's a lot of things that can be done to prevent contamination of drinking water and aquifer layers, which are typically several thousand feet above where they're actually drilling for oil and gas, or, you know, miles above a lot of times. So it's not something where they're drilling into the oil and gas formation and there's water there that we're, you know, drinking water there. We're just pumping contaminants in there. These are formations that are not usable or not suitable for drinking water anyway. They're contaminated with other things, you know, the deeper you go typically. And so the areas that you want to protect, there's things that they do. And so Justin, we want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the most common misconceptions about hydraulic fracturing is that the fractures created threaten the aquifers and other drinking water sources, as Matt mentioned, and it's simply just not true. Operators are required to provide multiple barriers in the form of casing pipe that's cemented through the water-bearing zones and special testing procedures to ensure the integrity of the wellbore and the cement layer in those critical areas. The reason this is done is because the only way an aquifer could become contaminated is if the oil and gas or chemicals were to travel up along the outside of the wellbore between the pipe and the formation and into the freshwater zones. This is prevented by multiple pipes that are cemented, like we mentioned, and ensuring that the cement fully fills the space between the pipe and the rock formation that's being protected. And again, Matt, you know, I think it gets a really bad rap because people assume you're just sticking a straw into a cup. And people don't realize that there's those multiple layers of casing that are allowing that oil and gas to flow through it.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And these steps are required by regulation and test to confirm that there's a good wellbore integrity before the step of completing the well is allowed to proceed. The term completions or completing a well refers to the steps that are performed after the well is drilled and the casing is cemented in place. This is usually after the drilling rig is moved off the pad. The completions process today involves setting up portable water tanks, dozens of high-pressure pumps on semi-trailers, sand, pipes, and valves, and other equipment on the well pad to allow the service company to follow the recipe outlined by the completions engineer. Today, a modern horizontal well has multiple frac stages along the length of the horizontal wellbore that travels through the target formation. The number of frac stages that are used depends on the lateral length of the wellbore, but it's not uncommon for there to be dozens of stages or individual fractures that are made at certain intervals. Once the plugs separating the fracture stages are drilled out or plugs removed and fracking equipment is moved off, the wells are flowed back. This is the initial process of unloading the well, and oil and gas is allowed to flow from the well along the majority of the frac fluid and sand. This is a temporary process that usually lasts for a few days to a few weeks, and specialized flowback equipment, affectionately named sand traps, which includes sand separators and other equipment to effectively handle the flowback fluid and higher initial flow rates than the typical production equipment is designed to handle. Finally, once the flow rates are decreased to within the design parameters of the permanent production facilities, the wells are connected to the production facilities and handed over to the operations team to take care of them from there. And, you know, Matt, it's just amazing the complexity of the process nowadays. And it's by design to be sure that you have the best experts on the right area and that you're doing it safely and having multiple touch points to be sure that you are doing it safely.
That's right. There's a lot of safeguards in place. They test, you know, along the way. There's pressure testing that occurs before they start pumping the frac to make sure there's no issues with any of the piping or equipment that's hooked up. And so this is modern process of applying the latest techniques and latest processes to drill and complete the wells. And, you know, these can be done in days, whereas it used to take several months to drill, a long horizontal well. Now they've gotten it down to where they're drilling, you know, some of these wells in, you know, just a few days, and then they're bringing in completions crew. And of course, depending on the number of frac stages, they're completing them in just a couple of days. And, you know, this adds up if you're drilling two dozen wells from a single well pad. So that time for each well, you know, can adds up as they're, you know, the rig may be on site for a couple of months, but they're, you know, now drilling maybe 20 or 30 wells on that single well pad in that time period. So it's pretty impressive to see how technology and the procedures that are followed have moved into more of a manufacturing type mode. So it's pretty cool to see. And you know, the thing that is interesting too is once the rig is gone, they've completed the wells, and you are left with, you know, a smaller well pad. They usually do some interim reclamation where they'll plant grass seed and things like that, and make sure that final footprint of that well pad is a little bit smaller and it only is as big as they need to have it to fit the well pad, maybe room if they need to bring a workover rig on site, and then any production facilities that are there as well. And if you were to drive up to a modern well pad, you might see separators, dehydrators, meter buildings, and basically what you would see is just looks like a series of tanks or pressure vessels that are kind of all concentrated in one part of the well pad, usually away from the well heads. And there are flow lines that are run below ground from the wellhead to the production facilities. And then from there, once they go through the production facilities and the oil and water and natural gas are separated, they'll then be sent to the gathering pipeline, off to maybe a gas plant in the case of the natural gas, or off to the oil pipeline. And in some cases, though, you might see just a series of wellheads and there's no other equipment on site. In some locations, operators build central processing facilities so that those steps are all taken care of at a central location. So you'll have multiple well pads that are hooked up to gathering pipelines that pump the fluids to that central processing facility to then separate the oil, water, and gas, you know, at that point, and then treat the gas to send it to the gas pipeline. And so it's pretty impressive to see the advancements in technology, you know, from the early days of the wooden derricks and steam-powered drilling rigs to today's fleet of modern electric drilling rigs, the efficient completion techniques, and that, you know, modern production equipment that I mentioned. And, you know, you think about, too, the way that we've gone about looking for oil and gas has changed. You know, in the past, Justin, you'd hear of, you know, a lot of exploration work, and you'd hear of operators drilling dry holes or oil, you know, basically a well that didn't strike oil or gas. And that was where they would go after conventional oil and gas plays, where you'd have a geologist that would evaluate seismic data to try to determine where there might be source rock that could allow oil and gas to trickle up into a geologic trap where it would get basically trapped and contain a reservoir of oil or gas. And so then what they would do is try to drill a well vertically, again, in that patchwork fashion to tap that potential reserves. And if they were lucky, they would hit oil or gas. Sometimes it wouldn't be in commercial quantities. There might be oil or gas there, but there might not be very much. And so they would have to cap it and go on to the next location. In fact, you know, back in those days, there was maybe a 1/3 of every well would be successful. So it was definitely a bit of trial and error. And, you know, once they did tap into a successful reservoir and they maybe tapped out that initial production, they would go in and inject water downhole or inject CO2 and use what's called enhanced oil recovery to drive more oil and gas towards a production well from those injection wells to try to extract just a little bit more of that oil and gas. And so, you know, you had these different techniques, which were a lot more reliant on, you know, having a really good geologist and having access to good data and, you know, figuring all that stuff out and to hopefully strike oil or gas. And what we have now is this combination of hydraulic fracturing with horizontal drilling. And the thing that also is interesting is we have what's termed a resource play. So a lot of times you have these very uniform layers of these shales that are now being produced. And so we actually have the data and to say, okay, here this shale formation occurs in this widespread area. And we know for a fact that there is oil and gas entrapped in that shale that in the past you could drill a vertical well down there and try to complete it using those older techniques, but you know, it just wouldn't flow just because we weren't there yet from a technology standpoint. Now we've gotten to the point where we can tap into those with horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing from a single well pad and efficiently and effectively extract the oil and gas below multiple square miles of land in a particular layer of rock that used to be thought of either just a source rock or maybe a cap rock that would have been a trap, but actually in and of itself contained the oil and gas that we can now economically produce. So it's pretty cool to see the advancements in technology in the industry.
Absolutely. We've come a long ways, and a wildcatter is a phrase that you used to hear a lot, and that referred to those guys going out and drilling those vertical wells. And it's a lot more efficient use of resources, the way that we're doing it today, by doing the research ahead of time and continuing to push that technology forward. You know, Matt, I'm sure being in the industry, you would know better, but I'm sure geologists are kind of the rock star of the situation these days.
Yeah, they are definitely the rock stars that have figured this out. You know, they were the ones, I think, that originally determined, you know, that, hey, what if we combined, you know, these techniques to drill into this? You know, we've seen maybe evidence of there being oil and gas in these shales, you know, as they've drilled through them to target other conventional formations. And then somebody had the bright idea to, well, what if we actually targeted that formation? Let's go try it. And it was Mitchell Energy that really was the first to do that in the Barnett Shale. And they actually were able to make it work. And that sort of triggered that shale revolution, you know, back in the early 2000s. And so, you know, again, it just takes, you know, innovation, you know, individuals with tenacity and the fortitude to not give up and to figure it out and then basically transform the industry here in the U.S. from sort of a dying industry to the U.S. being the largest producer of oil in the world. And so it was a pretty amazing story if you think about the last two decades here in the United States and the amount of innovation that's occurred in this industry.
Absolutely. And it has a major positive impact on the environment as well as a significant reduction in surface impact. You know, lower emissions that operators produce while producing more oil and gas is having a smaller impact on the environment than ever before. And because the energy needs today cannot be met by renewable energy by itself, these advancements in technology will allow us to reduce our carbon footprint and will make oil and natural gas more sustainable for the future. By ensuring cheap, reliable, sustainable oil and gas production in the United States, we're positioned to help meet the energy needs of the world today and tomorrow until there's something better. And, you know, I think there's a lot to be said, and we say this a lot, Matt, that if we're going to have to do this, which is the situation we currently find ourselves in today, don't we want the most responsible country in the world doing it rather than letting other countries maybe not meet the same environmental bar?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Justin. In fact, we talked about this in episode 119, where we talk about the carbon intensity of U.S. oil production as compared to OPEC and Russia. You know, we have this amazing natural resource that we have at our fingertips here in the United States that we can responsibly produce and do so in an environmentally conscious way. And I think, you know, the regulations that we have here in the U.S. are certainly some of the most strict of any country in the world and getting more so, you know, by the day. And so operators are able to operate within that framework and do so efficiently and do so profitably. And so I think it's important that as we get into this situation, as we're lifting up these developing countries and they have the same expectation of cheap and reliable energy, that we help, you know, lift up humanity and provide them with that. Because, you know, it's easy for us sitting here in the United States in our heated home, looking at the internet, and then talking and as we're recording this episode using energy to do this, it's not free, right? And there are trade-offs, but I think it does make a lot more sense for us to leverage this technology here in the United States, you know, especially with private property rights that we have and mineral ownership. The economic benefit is even just, you know, compounded even more because it's helping individual royalty owners as these resources are developed here in the U.S. versus if we call, you know, Russia up or Saudi Arabia up on the phone and say, hey, can you guys please pump some more oil? Our gas prices are getting too high. You know, that seems sort of like a silly way to go about it if you think about the benefit that we could have both from an economic standpoint and then certainly from an environmental standpoint versus having Russia, but like we said, you know, objectively has a higher carbon footprint for every barrel of oil produced as compared to the United States. So, you know, why not do it here instead of relying on them and exporting that carbon emissions to another country?
You nailed it, Matt. Energy poverty is not a place that we want anyone should be in today's world.
Absolutely. Well, we hope that you all enjoyed this recap of the history of the oil and gas industry and some of the major technological innovations that have occurred over the past 162 years since Edwin Drake tapped that first well in Titusville, Pennsylvania. If you found this interesting and want to hear more stories like this, or you know, have any suggestions for future episodes, send us an email at feedback@mineralrightspodcast.com. And if you could do us a huge favor, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. It helps other mineral and royalty owners find this information, and it makes Justin and I feel good about ourselves. So please help us out. So thanks again for listening.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks so much for listening to the Mineral Rights Podcast with your host, Matt Sands. Don't forget to subscribe and share at mineralrightspodcast.com. The Mineral Rights Podcast should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy.